You're listening to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie, episode 62.
Welcome to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
Hey, folks, this is Dr. Donnie, and I am telling you I'm excited that the Get Balanced Podcast has an official sponsor, and I want to tell you a little bit about them. And it is FirstNet, built with the AT&T. And what I want to tell you about them is probably part of it is that many of you already know this, but for first responders and frontline workers, communication, as we know, is not a luxury, but it's a lifesaver. And that's why FirstNet, built with AT&T, was created. Now, the FirstNet mission is to make communication faster, safer, and more collaborative for first responders and other public safety personnel. FirstNet helps first responders and frontline workers connect when they are on and off duty. They get access to priority and preemption capabilities. This means they connect to the network first. In emergency situations, first responders move to the front of the line to access critical bandwidth they need to send and receive, whether it's voice, data, video, images, and text. Now, during an emergency, FirstNet is a critical connection between first responders to technology and also to each other, giving them access to information quickly and when every second counts. With FirstNet, first responders and frontline workers get a highly secure, reliable network with 24/7, 365 customer care and monitoring. Now, to get more information about FirstNet, go visit your local AT&T store or visit firstnet.com. Now, let me go in and introduce our guest for this week. Hey, welcome to the Get Balanced Podcast with Dr. Donnie, and I am your host. And today, my special guest, many of you know him. I mean, if you're on LinkedIn, if you've pay any attention to all about what goes on in our culture, in some of law enforcement, and just truly an outstanding individual. This is law enforcement officer Dion Joseph, who is also a public speaker, trainer, and just great overall educator in helping. Before I go into all that he helps, let me just bring Dion in, and I'm going to ask you to talk about that. Dion, welcome to the show.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you, doctor.
Absolutely. So Dion, if you would tell us a little bit about the work that you're involved in, that you have been involved in, and what you've been doing for the last 20 or so years.
Well, for 25 years, I've been a police officer in the Los Angeles area. 23 of those years spent working with the homeless in various capacities. First capacity, obviously, as a patrol officer, making arrests, saving lives, doing what we have to do to try to keep people safe. And then I ended up working in an undercover capacity for 2 years, seeing a side of Skid Row that completely blew my mind. And I thought I knew what Skid Row was, but then I learned something new when I went undercover, and that was very enlightening. Then I left to work with children for about a year and a half as a juvenile investigator, finding runaways, missing kids, protecting kids from child molesters and abusers in their families. And then I came back as a training officer, where I tried to create mini-me's, new probationers, and teach them the honorable and integrity of our job, to go out there and be police officers that are aggressive in the best of ways. When I say aggressive, not in the negative way, but as far as fighting crime, but as well as opening your heart and caring for the community you serve, you can do both and be successful. And then I ended up being the senior lead officer, the lead officer in charge of their safety in 2005. So the past 16 years, I've been dedicated to helping the homeless, the downtrodden, the mentally ill, the homeless, the women who are sexually exploited, you name it, I've been doing it. I always tell people I'm not just the senior lead officer for service providers, caseworkers, drug counselors, pastors. I'm also the senior lead officer for sex workers, drug addicts, drug dealers, and pimps. Now, if you're breaking the law, I'm coming for you. But I don't care if you're a crip. If you need my help, it's my job to help you. And I take great pride in that job. And now, a side of my current career, I have taken it upon myself to try to educate the public about the realities of homelessness through public speaking, doing consulting to other agencies, talking to advocacy groups about the reality of homelessness so we can help the homeless from a truth-based foundation, not a political one. Because as we see, politics is destroying the fiber of every noble thing we've tried to do. And it doesn't matter if it's left or right. I don't consider myself left or right. I'm a centrist because I believe from an objective and centered place, we can see the right place to land. And that's what I'm trying to do, is get everybody back to the center and stop politicizing police work, homelessness, and all these important issues so that we can make our country strong again. That's what it's all about for me now.
Yeah. Well, those are remarkable initiatives and things that you've been doing. Outstanding. And
thank you,
Dion. What do you think from a from the public's perspective, what is it that they should learn that they probably just don't know when it comes to this homelessness problem?
Well, a lot of people are looking at homelessness from a 30,000 foot view. A lot of them have received a lot of misinformation and even worse, disinformation from various sources, whether it be the negative exception of media, people, advocates who have a vested interest in keeping places like Skid Row exactly where it is, who have the microphone and they just won't get off stage. And because of that, people have been guided to the thought that every homeless person you see out there is because they're just lost their housing or they lost their apartment. And I always ask people the question, if you lost your house or your apartment today, would your first inclination be to go set up a tent in one of the most dangerous places in the United States of America? And everybody I ask says, absolutely no. I'm going to be couch surfing for a minute, house, sleeping in my car, or I'm going to go beat down the doors of a shelter to get in. So, but my goal is not to demonize the homeless. In fact, if you allow me, I have to humanize them because I love them. The people, the homeless people I serve are pretty much no different than anywhere else in the United States of America. There's four groups of them like any other part of the country. And the first group is good people. You have to understand people, everybody listen, they are good, wonderful human beings in Skid Row. And that's why I can't leave them. No matter how hard things are, I care about them and I want to help them. I want to help create an environment where they can change and better their lives. Then you have good people who do bad things. These are your drug addicts who, when they're sober and they have a safe environment to get clean in, guess what? We find out they're educated. They had degrees. They were athletes. They were actors. They were artists. But one hit of crack and they were on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder. It was one and done. You fell faster than your more affluent counterparts in other parts of the city or county. Then you have your ex-convicts who made mistakes, they paid their debts, but you know, in an environment where they have conducive to change, guess what? They make better decisions. But of course, when it's off the chain, drug dealers everywhere, they have a tough choice to make. I'm only getting $221 a month. If I can't beat them, I might as well join them, and they end up recidivizing again. And then you have the last groups, the career criminals, who it's their job to come down and prey upon people. Those people do exist by the hundreds in Skid Row. You have to know that. Now, here's what's different about those four groups juxtaposed to anywhere else in the United States of America. The first group, the good people, they have to look the other way when bad things happen so they don't become victims of crime themselves. I can't tell you how many investigations where I saw someone get shot or stabbed on video and the witnesses, good witnesses, were right there. But because they have no place else to go to get help, they remain silent so they don't get 86 by the criminal element. For the good people who do bad things, the drug addict, they stay on the bad side longer because they don't have an environment conducive to change. How do you get clean when the drug dealer is not only outside your drug program, but they pay off security and even some of the caseworkers to come in and infiltrate the housing programs and what do we call turn the place out? So it makes it impossible for someone really trying to change their life in what's supposed to be a recovery zone. Then you have the third group, the ex-convicts, like I said. Drug dealers making $1,000 on the corner. Your parole agent only gave you $221 a month to survive on. What am I going to do here? I'm going to choose the latter and I'm going to engage in crime or what we call work. Whenever you hear the term work in Skid Row, that's not a good thing. Work is oftentimes extortions, debt collections, brutalizing people in the name of protecting the territory of the gang and getting paid for it. And then the last group, the criminal element, the career criminals, they pull all the strings and run the community activists to help tie our hands so that they can get a bigger chunk of the pie as it relates to exploiting the people and their vices in Skid Row. So that's Skid Row in a nutshell, but I assure you that most of the people are good people. It's sometimes hard to see when the only thing the media and people focus on are the tents and the crime, which I understand should be focused on so people can get a healthy balance of what's going on or a greater sense of what's going on there. But yes, there are wonderful people, and we need to be allowed to create that environment conducive to change so that the influence of the service providers, the 108 programs there, can be stronger than that of the criminal element. That's all I want to do. It's not about persecuting people because they're homeless. That is the biggest lie told about our initiative to reduce crime. But we're stuck now. We're all in a tough place right now, and crime's high and people are victimized like I haven't seen since the 90s. And it's unfortunate, but I'm not going anywhere. Those people need me.
Well, Dion, I hear the word, and you've used the word love several times in the first 10 minutes or so of the podcast here. Where does that love come from?
My parents. You know, my parents, they were incredible human beings. Like, my parents were, they were just legendary in their love for the community. I grew up in Long Beach, but their stories were very interesting. They raised 41 foster children in their 47-year marriage.
Wow.
On top of their four kids and three grandchildren, that's what they did. So I had to share my love for my parents with so many people, but I never felt a sense of resentment for it because it was awesome to watch my parents take a broken child or teenager and in 2 weeks or 2 years, mend them back, love them back to health through a non-patronizing style of love. And what I mean by that is not little Billy, it's okay, you kicked a hole in my wall. Hey, you're going through problems. That's okay. No, if Deion Joseph got in trouble, they got in trouble. If Deion Joseph got a hug and a kiss, they got a hug and a kiss. And it was so beautiful to watch that when it was time for some of these kids to leave, they left our homes kicking and screaming, not even wanting to go back to their parents because they felt love from a place they were indoctrinated or taught not to expect it. And that was from an adult. The other incredible thing about that journey my parents took was they would secretly go and mentor the families, the mother and fathers of these kids, so that they could reunite and become better parents. And this was just crazy. It was just watching my parents heal people was beautiful. And then my father, who was grew up very, very poor in the Jim Crow South. He committed crimes to survive. Basically, he had no choice. He turned his life around, joined the military. And when he got out of the military, he said he would never hurt another human being to get by again in his life. And he started a construction business after working in the post office, digging ditches, collecting cans. People had faith in him, and he started his own business. And he reached back and hired individuals who reminded him of himself. They were criminals who needed a second chance, and he gave them a second chance. I was mad at my dad for a little bit because during my background investigations, when I was coming out of the police force, the investigator says, "Hey, have you ever associated with any known felon?" I'm like, "Heck no, come on now, I'm clean as a whistle. You see my background." Well, I didn't know. My father didn't tell me that I was digging a ditch next to a drug dealer. My dad never told me that I was wiring a house next to a convicted murderer whose nickname was Cowboy. And I was like, "Dad, why didn't you tell me this?" He says, "Look, I want to give these men a chance if they want it." And that was the key word. They had to want the chance. If they didn't want the opportunity, he was kicking them off the job site. And then lastly, my parents fed the homeless religiously every Saturday for 10 years up until my mother passed. And my mother missed birthdays, was late for my wedding, feeding the homeless, but that was God's calling on our life. So all that was in me. After about 3 months of wanting to get out of Skid Row, I sat there one day and realized that I was home. I knew these people already. My parents prepared me for this very, very arduous task of showing love to people from a place they didn't expect it. And that was from a police officer. So, yeah.
You're right. They are amazing people. My gosh.
They really are.
What a story.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you.
Wow. Now, was and when it comes to spirituality and religion, was that part of the family? Any religious belief or spirituality practices?
It was a huge part of our life. We're Christians, they stressed. I love their form of Christianity. Their form of Christianity was how much God loves us, no matter how many times we fall. I remember my dad, I came home and I was just bummed out that I didn't think I was helping anybody. And my mom and dad reminded me, they said, "Deion, whether someone's stressed out, sexed out, drugged out, ganged out, they're still loved by God. And if God never gives up on people, Jesus never gives up on people, you won't give up on anybody either." And they would always find a way to pick me up off the dirt and go, I'm going back in. Put me back in, coach. And my parents, that's their fault for why I don't give up. But their faith was huge in how they treated everybody. It didn't matter whether you were black, white, poor, gay, straight. My parents just loved everybody.
Yeah,
it was just a real, genuine, authentic love. Now, they never sacrificed their values for anybody, and I'll never do that. but they loved everybody. And I took that to heart in everything that I do.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the love that you have for your family, because I see pictures on the wall. I know this is a podcast. Mm-hmm. Listeners don't see that, but pictures on the wall. Tell us a little bit about your family, Dion.
Well, I am married to the most incredible woman on the planet, Tasha Joseph. This woman, I'm a police officer, as you guys know, and a lot of officers go through divorces because they don't have that shoulder to cry on or that person they can go and just get it all out to. My wife has been what we call ride or die from day one. And she came from a family of very anti-police people. Her family was like, they hated the cops with a passion because
time going over to her house like?
Oh, well, it was actually pretty good. It was when they found out I was going to be a police officer. That's when it was like, don't let them white boys change you. Oh, they're going to turn you into this. They made it seem that I was going to get called the N-word as soon as I stepped on the line. I was like, what is going on here? You know, but they really, really had a dislike towards police officers, and for valid reasons. My mother-in-law, wonderful soul, who she had some real traumatic experiences with a police department. And she was one of the most honest women. But anyway, but the one thing she said to me is, I love you and I have faith that you're going to be different. So I took that to heart as well. And I wanted to prove to her that police officers aren't what you make them out to be. In total, there's a negative exception and an honorable rule and everything. So that was my goal. But my wife stuck with me through all the hatred and all the other stuff that I got. She was there for me. And I love that woman to pieces. Then she gifted me with three beautiful sons. I mean, I couldn't ask for better children. My sons, you know, we raised them with the same values that our parents gave them, and it worked. You know, something about keeping those same strong, good values to love everybody, to not judge anybody, to help when you can, you know. And my sons are out there doing the same thing. Everywhere I go, I keep people go, oh, your sons are such good kids. They're fine, young man. I said, I know this.
Great to hear.
I'm proud of them.
How old are your sons?
I got twins who are 22. They're grown-ups out there in the workforce right now. And then I have my youngest who is 16, and they all remind me of me to some degree. I always have these proud dad moments, each of them. You know, my oldest son, Dion, he's about justice. If he sees something wrong, you know, he wants to fix it. He sees something he considers evil or wrong, he tries to stop it. You know, my son Xavier, he has a huge heart for people. He doesn't like to see people bullied or picked on. Funny story, this started when he was six. He saw a little girl hitting a duck with a stick, and he runs up and snatches the stick from the girl. They just make me proud. And then my youngest son, he hates violence. He doesn't like violence. You know, he just detests it. Not that he's afraid. It's just that he just doesn't believe that it's right to harm other human beings other than for self-defense. So each one of them make me proud, and they remind me of myself to a degree. So I'm a blessed man. I really am.
Oh, that is outstanding. Love that.
Yep.
And congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Well, as you know, in the podcast is the Get Balance. I talk a lot about work-life balance, and I want to get your view on some of that. But I want to share with you and the listeners just a little recap of when I say work-life balance, you know, it has nothing to do with how much time you spend at work or home or whatever. It's really about I ask people, I say, hey, are your day-to-day behaviors in alignment with your priorities in life? And to me, that's what balance truly is. And one of the things I did in my research, Dion, just a couple of years ago, was I evaluated these really highly effective people in their careers, but they're really effective with families. You know, they had great families too. And what came out was that they all took great care of themselves. They actually, their physical needs, their psychological needs, their social and their spiritual, they put self-care at the top of the list, because they were like, you know, for me to take care of my family and for me to take care and be effective at work, I have to take care of myself. Now, I'm looking at you on this screen and your 20-inch biceps. You have something to do with self-care, I know, in your life. So talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I got to be honest, that wasn't always the case. The reality is, the con of being raised by Milton and Margie Joseph was you become addicted to wanting to help people, and you put yourself second. They were selfless people. So when I got to be the lead officer in charge of the safety of Skid Row. I dove into that and I stopped taking care of myself and my family. And I just kind of like expected my wife to understand. I never missed a kid's game. I coached, but when it was time to go to work, these people had access to me almost 24 hours a day. They would call me at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm being stabbed. Why don't you call 911? Because we trust you, you know, things like that. And it got to a point to where my wife sat me down and says, Deon, I'm proud of you for everything you do. I love the man you are, but there's a group of people who need you more than Skid Row. And that's us. You give 120% to those people in Skid Row. But when you come home, you're so spent, you give us 60. And that's not working for me. And that broke my heart because she's my ride or die, you know. Yeah. But I took my ego out of it and says, you know what? She's right. So I remember it was the first time I broke my promise to my wife. I said, baby, you're right. I apologize. We're going to fix it. You and I, we're going to Vegas for 3 days, and I'm leaving my work phone at home. No phone calls from Skid Row or anybody else. I promised her that. We got on, went to Vegas, got to our hotel room. There was Luther Vandross playing, rose petals on the bed, chocolate strawberries and beer all everywhere. It was about to go down, right? I was about to romanticize my wife, right? And as the magic's about to happen, we hear the sound. Bzz, bzz, and it's my work phone going off in my back pocket. And I ran in the bathroom. Oh, baby, my stomach hurts. And I closed the door and I answered the phone. I was like, Officer Joseph, I can help you. A homicide? Oh, I know who did that. That's Pookie. And I forgot to lock the door. And when the door opens, it's my wife standing there in tears, and she left the hotel room for about an hour. That was the first time I broke a promise. I never broke a promise to my wife. And we had that long conversation. I said, baby, I just love these people so much. You don't understand what they're up against. They need somebody. And they're like, we need you. So that was a life changer. And I finally learned to sometimes leave the work phone at home and be more present in the lives of my wife and kids who love me to death. They were never mad at me, but they needed me. Look, if I get shot out there to the rest of the world after a couple of weeks, I'm going to be a serial number, you know? But to these people right here, they're the most important people who remind you constantly that the world is not a rolling dumpster fire in a dry forest. And that's why it's so important to invest in them. And that's going to help heal you. It's going to create that. It's going to empty a little bit of space where you can go back out there and take on the world without it destroying you. Another way it destroyed me is I was in such bad shape. I went from 230 pounds of pure muscle and strength and stamina. But after a while, went up to 265, 270. I think the heaviest I became was 270. I developed, my blood pressure became elevated and the stress, there was a lot of stress in my life. So I'm just now slowly getting that back. So everything you're doing, everything you're saying, I support. If you're a first responder out there, listen to this man. Focus on your family and your loved ones. They're the ones who need you the most when it hits the fan. Please do. And also, you got to do some other things to help yourself. Things that I did was I coached Little League, baseball, soccer. I don't even know how to play soccer. So it was fun watching kids kick the goal in the wrong hole. And like, hey, congratulations. but those little things help remind you that the world is still a beautiful place. Because when you're a law enforcement officer, oftentimes your job is to respond to the bad, the negative exception of our society. And if you keep doing that over and over again, you'll begin to think that's the rule. You know, that's just human nature. And you become more ultra paranoid about where your kids go because you know what's out there. But you know, really, just break your tunnel vision. And law enforcement, you have a saying that says, break your tunnel vision, because if you don't break your tunnel vision, you don't see the help that's on the left or the right. Yeah. So focusing on your family, dealing with other people who aren't criminals will help you break your tunnel vision that the world is not as bad as we may think it is.
Yeah. No, very excellent advice, Deon. And how about, if you would, talk a little bit about, if I asked you the question, say, describe yourself to me. Mm-hmm. Let's go with that. Describe yourself to me, Deon. Who are
very
you?
Interesting.
Who are you?
Okay. Well, to some people's surprise, I'm a very quiet and reclusive person. You know, like I don't make friends easy. And that's because of childhood trauma. There was trauma in my childhood by people who were supposed to love me. I call them loved ones because it reminds me that I still love them no matter what they did. And I had to forgive them so I could move on. But I never mentioned their names. I never say who they are. But they did. They left some scars on me, which developed mistrust of people. So I chose to love for a while people from a distance, from a safe distance, and wouldn't let them in. So I still struggle that to this day, but Skid Row kind of forced me out of that because I could not be effective just showing the people of Skid Row what I do. In order to be effective, I needed to show them who I am. And who I am, actually, deep down inside, when you peel back all the layers, is a very loving, patient, caring person. I do my best not to be judgmental of anybody's situation. I know that the reason why a lot of people are on drugs, some they went to a party and got high, others because of trauma, you know, and we need to look at them as human beings and not go beyond just, oh, they're just homeless. There's a story behind all of those individuals, just like there's a story with me. So that's who I am in a nutshell. I'm the type of friend, I'm not the kind of friend who's gonna go have a drink, a beer with you. That's not the kind of guy I am. But if you've ever been there for me in any capacity and it hits the fan in your life, the first one's gonna be at your door is Deion Joseph. That's another thing that I am. I am a big man of faith. I believe in God, like I believe in oxygen. You know, it's gotten me through a whole lot. And I know we're kind of in this era of anti-faith, anti-belief, anti-this, but I'm going to be a person of faith to the casket trials because it got me through some of the most trying times of my life. I hate injustice. I hate injustice. Year for years, I would work Skid Row and I would see victims who were stabbed and shot. And the district attorney at the time would say, DA reject, we're not going to file this case because this person is a drug addict or because they have a criminal history or because they're homeless. Those things drove me like nobody's business to keep fighting, to not just be a warrior, but to be a guardian. Other things about me people don't know is I love to write songs. I like to sing. You know, I'm not the best singer. When you don't work on your craft, you kind of lose it. So I went from a singer, as we say in our community, to a shower singer. I can hold a note. I sound good to myself. I'm a dedicated husband. I've been faithfully married to my wife for 24 years, been with her. She's the only woman I've been with for 26 years. And that I wear that with a badge of honor. And I try to tell men, and when I talk to men, it's like, it's an honor to be that guy, to be that guy who, you know, yeah, you can get a big badge for policing a whole lot of women, but it takes a hell of a man to make one woman happy for life, for a lifetime. I'm crazy about my kids. Yeah, you know, Deion Joseph could take a lot of abuse. I can. The department I work for, you've been taught or trained to take abuse. You just have to, it's part of the job. But don't mess with my family. Yeah, that's when I always say, I've been crazy long enough, I've been saved. That's when I kind of lose my cool and the old Long Beach DM comes out. So, but no, that's me in a nutshell. I love people with a passion. It's like I said, it's ingrained in my DNA and that's me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, for all the listeners out there, I want to point something out is that you just heard Deion talk about he's a godly man. He's a family man. And he also mentioned working on Skid Row and loving people. But what you did not hear coming right out of his mouth at the beginning was, I'm a police officer. Yeah. Did not state that that is your identity. And for all first responders out there, we're very proud of what you do. And all of you are, whether you're a firefighter, EMT, law enforcement officer, but the idea is you're so much more than that. But a lot of times young people in the job too, and it generally, I think it hits you when you're young, is that you identify, you know, becomes your part of your identity. And, what work-life balance truly is that, hey, it's a piece of us, what we do in a career. Yeah. It's a big piece of but who we are is about those close family, you know, those close relationships. It's about, if you are a believer, it's about that. There's so much more, you know, these pillars of life that we live. And so I'd love hearing your piece about how you explain who you are.
And that's why I tell these young officers all the time, I mentor officers once a month at the academy. And I talk to them about that. Don't ever sacrifice who you are. You know, I didn't. Yeah. You know, look, there's your blue family, and that's a real thing. You know, we love being police officers. We love what we do. We sign up to save lives. But in the end, when it's all said and done, what matters the most is your real family and those who love you. And bring who you are to the table. Look, you know, like you said, look, I'm a police officer, but that's not who I am. That's what I do. And I brought the best version of myself to that. I'd be the same way if I was a plumber. I'd still find a way to help foster kids. I still find a way to mentor kids if I was a plumber or a janitor. You know, that's who I am. I brought my experience as a African-American man. I don't believe necessarily in identity politics, but that part of my life is important in not only bridging gaps between these two communities, the law enforcement community and people of color. It's so important. So I bring all that understanding with me to help bridge those gaps and make the relationships better between our agency and the people that we serve, because I primarily have served all the way my entire career in locations where there are primarily people of color. So don't sacrifice who you are. Bring the best version of yourself, and that's when you're going to make a difference. Maybe not now on a macro level, because there's so much writing against us in the media and social media. You can't beat that. But on a micro level, in your reporting district, in your car, basic car, in your division, you can make a difference in that community and how they see you. And I love showing people who I am, not just what I do. That's the beautiful thing.
Yeah. That is excellent. And Dion, if you would, any advice for law enforcement? Well, any more though, it's like, we might as well include all first responders in this. I mean, the beat down from the media is definitely on law enforcement, but I'm getting alerts now so much more often than not about firefighters getting shot on a scene.
Yeah.
EMTs getting shot. There's one in critical condition right now in Tucson. It happened last night. Firefighter and a couple of EMTs, and don't know there. And it's a very bad and tragedy what's going on. But with the media and this constant bashing, if you will, it demoralizes, or it attempts to demoralize. Yeah, it attempts to bring morale down and things like that. What advice do you have for listeners out there to, you know, keep your head up? Because I tell people all the time, hey, man, I'm proud of you, you know, to all the brothers and sisters out there, proud of what you do, honored to have you. And every time I see law enforcement, whether I'm out on a run or something like that, you know, wave to them, you know, let them know, give them thumbs up. Hey, you know, I thank you, you know, but but for others, you know, that if they watch any of the news, you know, it's never usually a good story out there. They don't promote positive news.
Yeah. You know, what I tell all first responders is this: the true definition of a hero is not going out there and protecting and helping people who love and respect you. Anybody can do that. Even bad guys do that for their own. The true definition of a hero is when you can go out there and protect those who hate and loathe you as well. And if you want to be a hero, that's what it's about. And that's what I live by. I have this one mantra that I've lived by my entire career. And that's: my badge, my gun, my handcuffs will never be the means I utilize to invoke positive change in the lives of the people I serve. But my heart, my faith, and love for mankind will always be my unyielding dogs of war. These are what I pull out of this Sam Brown every day. And it's protected me better than my vest and weapon has for 25 years. Now, look, I'm not saying that I'm not going to go out there tomorrow and not lose my life. It could happen. But I can say honestly that for 25 years, no matter what the time frame was, and I've survived many eras. I was on the heel end of the Rodney King era. I came on in 95. I was during the Rafael Perez scandal, Rampart. You know, I hate calling it the Rampart scandal. It's not the Rampart scandal. It's the Rafael Perez scandal. I survived that and several other incidents nationwide. And I survived that in my community because no matter what, my love never changed. The way I treated them never changed. Instead of running from the controversy, I engaged the community. And that's what's worked for me. I know it's disheartening right now, especially now when it's not only, we understand it when it's Joe in his mom's basement switching from porn tube and cop hate videos, you know, him saying things and putting things out there. But I know it becomes especially more demoralizing when it's politicians and civic leaders who now are espousing the same rhetoric and leaving you out there on the front line, taking rocks and bottles and with all the hate. And not one person is standing up and saying, hey, that wasn't our cops. Those weren't our cops in Minneapolis that did that. That was one cop out there or anywhere in the country. But nobody's saying that. That could be demoralizing and disheartening. But when you get off that protest line, when you get through taking those rocks and bottles from people who are engaged in organized, staged outrage, that's what I call it, get back to your communities and give them your best. And over time, maybe not at a macro level, But on a micro level, we can begin to change the narrative community to community to community. Don't give up, man. The pendulum will swing, but it's not going to swing if we don't start pushing. And when I say push, I don't mean violence, but speak up for yourselves. Mm-hmm. If someone calls you a racist for wearing a uniform, you denounce that. You denounce that. And you say, that's not true. This uniform doesn't make me a racist. You know, you've probably saved more Black lives than your detractors have. And that's a fact. That's an undisputed fact. Just from you being present, you may not be the most proactive officer. You may not be the most proactive firefighter, but just your presence alone may have saved 10 lives just being there. Be proud of that. And don't let our detractors rob you of that. Hang in there. The pendulum's going to swing back. It will. I feel it already. Now, when you're hearing reports of these communities who were initially with pitchforks saying defund the police, now they're like, where are our police? And now those same politicians that threw you under the bus are feeling the heat, and slowly and on the down low, they're funding you again. So stay in the fight. You know why you came on the job. You knew it was tough. But remember, being a hero is protecting those that love you and those that hate you as well. Hang in there. We need you. Our communities need you.
Oh, absolutely. Very well said. And Deion, I want to, as we're coming up on our time here just a little bit, getting close, but I want to get your thoughts about and ask you, how have you handled from the mental, emotional part of things? Mm-hmm. You know, those critical incidents that you've been involved in, I'm sure, you know, many mm-hmm. of them. How do you handle that? You know, is it, you know, I know peer support in the last probably 5-10 years has been, you know, much more than what it used to be and things like that. But how did you process some of this stuff through in your career and still functioning on an extremely high level and putting love out there and not getting beat down by that?
You know what? Once again, I'm a strong person of faith, and every day before I'm not trying to apostolize to people, but the truth is, before I leave my house, I sit on my front porch and I ask my personal Lord and Savior to make me strong where I'm weak, give me the courage of a lion where I would cower, because I recognize that I could be afraid. I'm a human being, and where I'm broken, heal me in times of defense of others and myself, because I'm not the young 23-year-old who could bust through brick walls and jump over fences anymore. I'm still strong. I got 3 good butt whippings left in me, so don't try me. But these old bones, that's what they used to be, right? So, and I pray that prayer and I leave that there. And then I go out there with complete faith that someone else is in control, that God is in control. And the older I've gotten in my career, I've relied on that more, and it gets me through. Like, literally, this is not some kind of fantasy, pixie dust type stuff. Mm-hmm. When I say that to myself, it gives me faith and encourages me to go forward. And I recognize I'm going to have valleys. Those valleys are coming. You can't avoid them, especially if you're in an area where I work, or you're working in New York or Chicago or places like that, where all hell is breaking loose all around you. But it's very, very important to remember that. And also just the lives that you save. You think you can go your career 5 years and think, I'm not helping anybody. There was 3 times I wanted to quit mm-hmm. on this job. And what stopped me was 3 people that I felt like the good Lord sent my way to remind me of how important I was. So I was going to quit one day. And this drug dealer that I arrested like 2 years prior with a broken leg, he was selling crack, but he also threatened my life. He said, oh, you're dead. He called me the dead N-word. I won't say the word because I hate it with a passion. And for about a month, everybody on Skid Row was calling me dead end. I thought I was going to die. Hmm. And I never told my supervisors, because I know they would have pulled me out of the field. Because if you take me out of the field, it leaves the people I serve vulnerable to criminal element. So I came back about a month later and I saw this guy on the sidewalk, where now he looked 10 times worse. He was messed up. He's drug pipe, crack pipe in his hand. And I said, hey, it's time for you to go to jail. I walk up to him with these handcuffs. Yeah, okay, dead Negro, right? And he was like begging me, please, please, I don't want to go back to prison, please. And he smashes the crack pipe so I can't arrest him. And I walk up to him to put those handcuffs on. I was going to get him. This is revenge. And something in my heart said, pray for him. And I was like, are you kidding me? This guy just threatened to kill me. But something told me in front of all these criminals and drug addicts, just to counsel this man and pray for him. And I did that. 2 years later, he comes back to the station in a nice jumpsuit with sunglasses. I didn't even recognize him. And he says, you remember me? And I said, nah, bro, I don't remember. And he says, take my hand. And I was like, what? It was him. And he put inside of my hand a paper that he was clean for 2 years. And he thanked me for saving his life.
Wow. You know,
another young lady who I helped named Mimi, who this one broke my heart. And this is another time I wanted to quit. She was a drug addict, stone cold heroin addict, right? And I met her by nearly running her over with my car. You know, she jumped in front of my car on purpose to get a lawsuit.
Oh.
So she stops and she's cursing me out. And then I calm her down with some corny jokes. And then she says, I would sue you, but you're kind of cute. So thank you, God, for the cuteness back then. You know? And we ended up developing a friendship. And every day she wanted to hear a joke, but it went from that to, how are you doing it, Joseph, today? Can I pray for you? And I was like, you look like you need more prayer than me, baby. But she would pray for me. I let her do it. And then some days I would see her on the street with a needle in her arm, you know, fresh heroin in her system. And I would be like, wow. She said, Joseph, I don't want you to see me like this, but before you go, can you pray for me? And I was like, well, I'm a government official and all, but let me highlight you real quick. So I prayed for her there. Mm-hmm. I found out she had two children she wanted to get home to. And she would desperately try to get clean, but she just could never get clean because the environment, she didn't have the environment to. But Mimi wasn't just a crack addict, okay? Mimi was a hero. There was one day we went to the east side, and it was very, very dark in this part of Skid Row. Bonfires everywhere, tents rocking, countless people around, gang members. And I pull up next to this tent, and we get this call that there was a kidnap in progress. And I get on my microphone and say, hey, did anybody see a kidnap? Somebody get kidnapped around here? And everybody's like, oh, we didn't see anything. Right? They're scared.
Yeah.
So my partner says, let's get the hell out of here. Let's go eat. We drive about 50 yards and this skinny, shadowy figure jumps up and says, stop, stop, stop. And she runs up to my window and to Mimi. She says, please, they're going to kill that man. That tent you were parked right next to, please go help that man. They're going to kill him. I hate this stuff. She hated this stuff. Hmm. Back my car up, open the tent. Mimi wasn't just a crack addict. She saved a man's life that day. Now, Mimi taught me something. That once again, because somebody is a drug addict, doesn't mean that there's not a decent person somewhere inside there.
Right.
One day I came to work from vacation and a detective comes to me and says, Joseph, there was a homicide on the Far East Side. Can you help us solve it? They say, you know, everything that's going on out there. I said, yeah. Oh, I know a girl named Mimi. She's going to tell me everything you want to know. And the detective said, what? I said, yeah, Mimi. And then he goes over to his file and pulls out a file and opens it up. And it's a picture of my friend Mimi laying on the sidewalk with a belt tied around her neck as she slept on the sidewalk. Someone murdered her, just randomly choked her to death for no reason at all. And that was a time I wanted to quit. But 2 days later, I went to her where she died and I put some flowers down there. And an elderly lady comes up to me and tells me how Mimi talked about me, how much she loved me, mm-hmm. and how much of a hero Mimi was. And I was like, oh my God, I was just about to quit. And Mimi from beyond the grave gave me a message of hope to keep being the best version of myself. So hang in there, guys. I know you've saved somebody's life. Don't you ever doubt that, in spite of what the haters say. Don't doubt that.
Yeah, man. Very inspirational. Now, we're not going to have the time, but for listeners, if you search on YouTube for Deon Joseph, and I'll put it in the show notes on my website, because you could talk a while about Hurricane Linda, right?
Oh, that's my girl. I miss her.
And so I'll direct people to go see your TED Talk that you did just last year in for that one. Great, great story. And I could tell completely touched you on that. And but I want to let me ask you real quick, Deon, is there anything that I did not ask you that you wished I would have, or anything you'd like to spend more time on?
Well, it was focused on wellness, so I think you covered that, but I still hold the people struggling with mental illness near and dear to my heart. We have to change the system. We can no longer continue to believe that we can help somebody in 72 hours or less.
Right.
I don't want to see the asylums come back. I thought those places were inhumane. And unfortunately, America's response to certain failures is to throw the baby out with the bathwater when we should just fix the bathwater so we can clean the baby. But once again, I don't want to see those things come back. I don't want to violate anybody's civil rights. But we can no longer believe we can help somebody 72 hours or less. It should be 6 weeks, especially if it's somebody suffering from dual diagnosis. We see that all the time. And these are folks who you know, because of substance abuse and mental illness, become a danger to themselves and others. And that's when they become a police problem. It should be 6 weeks, because it takes about 6 weeks for them to benefit from their from the therapeutic attributes of their medication. And then you have to get the drugs out of their system, develop a rapport, and we have to change the conservatorship to make it easier for loved ones. I can't tell you how many emails and Facebook posts I get about people saying, Joseph, can you help me find my friend and my cousin, my mom in Skid Row? But because the way the system is, they don't hold them long enough for the family members to even get to them and even begin the process of conservatorship. So there's a systemic changes that we should make. And hopefully we can talk about that on another episode. But that's huge to my heart. We can fix this if we really want to. There's some things we can fix.
I would like to, I'd love to have another episode with you, because I'm completely with you there. And I think a lot of listeners that have any experience with this, that, you know, you just wish, my gosh, 3 days, you know, that's it. Yeah. And then they're going to be back where you don't want them and things like that. It's terrible.
Yeah. And it's not even 3 days anymore. It's 6 hours. They're just checking boxes. We brought them here. We sprinkled them with pills and we let them out the door, only to be a police problem again. And that's just sad. It's tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me ask you too, is that, Deanna, I want to give you an opportunity. And what I like to, the way I try to approach this is that imagine, I don't know, 10 years or so down the road, that your three sons pick up this podcast, just thought, you know what, this is from 10 years ago. Let me hit play. What would you like for them to know how you feel about them?
That is simple. I am proud of each and every one of them. They make me proud every day. I hate when parents say, or people say about our young generation, well, their kids, they're going to do drugs. Their kids, they're going to go out there and they have 10 babies. Look, I think higher of my children than that. When you instill morals and value and they take to it and they embrace it and they apply it to their daily lives and you see them doing it, that makes me proud as a dad. So my sons, if you're watching this 10 years from now, your dad is proud of you. I love you. And I thank you for being blessings to my life and your mom's life.
Outstanding. Yep, that's it. Yep. And how about to your wife, Tasha? What would you like for her to know?
To my wife, you are literally, and I know it sounds cheesy, the wind beneath my wings. When my confidence is low, you're the one that tells me that I can do anything, that I'm a good man. There are days where I feel like a complete failure, and you remind me I haven't failed because I haven't stopped trying. You know, so to my wife, not only are you a gorgeous woman, I mean, I hit the lottery, guys. You know, my wife is not just a beautiful, strong spirit, you know, but she's also a beautiful woman. So I hit the jackpot. To my wife, I am forever indebted to you for loving me for who I am and seeing who I am, no matter what kind of day I'm having, and continuing to push me out there. And I'm going to continue for them and for her to keep pushing and putting their truth out there and try to heal hearts and minds. I'm going to keep doing that.
Outstanding. Outstanding. And Officer Joseph, if you would you like to give our first responders a final blessing prayer to close out this podcast?
Absolutely. Father, I just pray for our first responders today, that you, in this environment, that you make them strong where they're weak. Father, that you give them the courage of a lion where they would cower, and where they're broken emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, that you would heal them in times of distress. We need you now more than ever. So my thoughts and prayer for every man and woman who goes out there, puts on a uniform, and selflessly protects people. We're not perfect, you know, but we are perfectly flawed, as I say, you know, but most of us are out there doing the best we can to help others. And I just pray that you lift our heads in this tough time and get us through this rough patch. And so we can get back to doing the noble job of protecting and serving. In Jesus' name I pray.
Amen. Amen. Thank you very much, Dion. This is truly an honor. And may you be blessed, blessed with safety, as well as your family and all of your brothers and sisters that you work with out there. Thank you again very, very much.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks for having me.
Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.